Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very, very accomplished entrepreneur from the world of education from Mumbai, India, Dr. Akhil Shahani. Akhil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh. Great to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Shahani is the managing director of the Shahani Group. He runs a franchise range of colleges in areas like business, media, real estate, finance, and others. He runs an edtech platform, which is Ask.Careers, and a recruitment firm, which is Ask Talent Services. He's the chairman of Global Discovery Schools. Dr. Shahani has been one of the top 50 thought leaders in education, and he's been recognized and felicitated several times. So, Akhil, before we start getting into the Shahani Group and the work you're doing, tell me a little bit about your own journey.
My own journey. Okay. So, you know, Steve Jobs actually said it very well, that life has to be lived forwards and sort of understood backwards, right? And he gave three random examples from his life in that famous Stanford speech as to how the stuff that he learned actually came together to actually help him to become who he is. So I had a very similar background, right? So I did my engineering undergrad in Thadmashani Engineering College, did my MBA at Kellogg, and worked in the software industry in the States for a few years. And I did quite well there. And I said, okay, let me sort of come back to India, start a software company. We'll do very well and be a multimillionaire by the age of 35 and relax on the Bahamas. I did come back to India. And unfortunately, I started my company and everything that could go wrong went wrong.
Okay.
And, you know, for example, right from the time of me creating a software product called Knowledge Management 1999, which was ahead of its time, classic case of a solution looking for a problem. People said, great software, but what are we going to use it for? So this is software that is like what we understand as collaboration software today, but I think we were a little ahead of our time. Beyond that, a lot of mismanagement happened, frankly, from my side. I had one of my partners left. My CEO, I discovered, was embezzling. Literally went downhill, and after 5 years, wound it up. So I said, you know, so the first thing I thought is to say that why is the education from one of the best business schools in the world not useful to help me run an actual business in India, in the real world? So he said that's one thing. The second learning, after that, I started a speakers bureau where we basically got international speakers into India, John Gray, Tony Robbins, to come to talk to people about how to live their lives. And what I found interesting is that there are a lot of people in the audience, you know, highly educated people, MBAs, PhDs, who are listening to very basic information of how to deal with your family, how to manage your spouse, and who are crying away, saying, you know, like in the middle of the session, they would go to the lobby and call up their spouse and say, or call up their dad and say, I'm so sorry I didn't talk to you all this time. And, you know, the funny thing, they had these emotional issues happening, and they sort of came out with these sessions. And I asked myself the question, why doesn't the education system teach how to manage your life?
Correct.
In school or college, why do these people who are highly educated not know how to run their lives? So that's the second learning. The third learning was really more to understand is that, and this is part of my PhD research in employability, is that what we discovered is that globally, 74% of employers are not happy with the quality of education out there in the world. They're saying that most employers, this is especially in the UK, US, and things like that, employers are saying that graduates coming from college are not employable. So I said, look, considering that you have the best universities out there in the US, UK, why are they not able to come out with the best quality employed candidates? And I said, it doesn't make sense because obviously it's not, you can't blame the government. There's something else.
Correct.
So three things. One is that why doesn't a business education teach you how to run a business? See, why doesn't a school and college teach you how to run your life? And third is that why aren't colleges coming up with employ the graduates globally? So all these three insights sort of coalesced into my current model and said, can we create an education system that makes people successful in life, not just in academia? So that's really where I came to.
Amazing. And that's how the Shahani Group started. And as they say, the rest is history.
Well, so far.
You know, I almost thought you were going to tell me when you started your journey that at 35, you'll come and make your millions and go to the Bahamas. I said, you made your millions, but decided to stay on in Mumbai or Bombay.
Yeah,
but then you changed the story. But
well, it's a very exciting. Honestly, I've told my wife that I'm never going to retire, and you know, I'm going to die with my boots on. So I really can't imagine sitting in a beach resort and just doing nothing.
Absolutely.
And you probably know this, right? And you talk about your story before we start the interview. Is that, you know, even though you yourself have done so many things, you're still involved in something that engages you mentally. So I think as long as you're engaged mentally and you feel that you're achieving something, not for yourself, but even for the world, you never lose that interest. You never lose that drive.
Very well said. You know, and that is such a powerful lesson that you are talking about, and how important it is to keep doing something irrespective of how old you may be.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. But let me now come to the Shahani Group. You know, you're in colleges, schools, and you've got your technology platforms. Tell me a little bit about how you are working with so many different and diverse businesses and yet managing them so well.
Well, maybe my wife will tell me that I've got multiple personality disorder, but so the serious part is that, okay, so it sort of leads on from the three insights that I mentioned earlier. So I said, look, the thing is that in spite of education, we're not able to train employers or graduates. So he said, let's understand what's the problem. And it's obviously not an issue of money or a willingness of the academic community. So we said, let's understand what does employability mean? Because we said that if you want to make someone successful in life, first make them successful in their careers, and then by default, like with the Maslow hierarchy, first get your food and security sorted, then you can look at higher areas of self-involvement and self-improvement. So he said, let's understand what's this conundrum called employability. So I researched with around 250 companies and universities around the world and said, what exactly do you mean by employability? The problem is that nobody has a definition. So what happens is that when you ask any recruiter, okay, when you're looking for an employable candidate, what do you mean? The recruiter will come up with things like, oh, you know, I want a guy who'll get the job done. Someone says, I want that ambitious person. I want someone who's got that glint in their eye. And you look at most job descriptions which are posted on these job portals, they come up with very stupid qualitative information like wanted dynamic, proactive sales guy. Or, you know, like someone who can get the job done. What does that mean? Because when you're looking from academia, the academics will say, look, I need to come up with standards I can teach towards, which will be applicable across all sectors, from commerce to science to engineering. And I can teach students at scale in a measurable manner. Now, since there's no measurable standards of employability which are defined by the corporate world, academics think, okay, besides exams and maybe assignments, there's no other standard I can develop people to. So what we did, what my research came up with, is said that, okay, let's define what's employability. So what we defined is basically five lower common denominator things, what every employer wants. One is a person with strong communication, strong collaboration capability, strong critical thinking, a proactive mindset, and a professional work ethic. That's it. Nobody wants a creative magnet. No employer wants to get a guy who thinks too much. They want the person to get the job done. They said, okay, work well with team members, be proactive, just think on your feet and communicate well. That's it. We don't want your brilliant ideas how to run the strategy of the business. I said, great. So we created these parameters, and we've created a complete education model that develops students on these parameters to make them employable. So the manifestation of that is that we are able to create, make people employable right across our offline colleges, the Padma Shahani Center for Management Group. We have the online platform Ask Careers. We have the placement firm Ask Talent Services. So all of these work together to create a seamless model, that 360-degree model, where you're able to educate kids offline, online, and placement. And with placement, I understand what the employer wants. I can constantly get closer and closer to my client, because the best business is one that understands their client and delivers to their client. For us, the client is a recruiter, not the student. So if I come up with the best quality product for the client, which is the graduate, then they get better jobs and they're more employable. So that is really the central point.
Thank you. What a great response. Thank you so much. Let me now come to education. You know, there's been a lot of debate about education in our country. We know that Indian parents are, you know, are willing to do anything to educate their children.
Right.
Where is the expectation gap between what the parents expect and what institutions are capable of delivering?
Okay, so look at it this way, right? And I'm giving an example from my days. I went to dual school, a boarding school, right? And those days, you know, we had no tuition, no nothing. We used to like run around, get dirty in the field, do archery, play around, and, you know, just build up all-around education and sort of personality. And, you know, a lot of boarding school graduates tend to have a certain personality that tends to be very rough and tough and brilliant, right? Now, the problem is that when you look at parents today, and it goes back to the whole concept of measurement, right? So, for example, is that if I'm a parent, And I want to say, how do I know that my kid is doing better than somebody else's kid? They may not say it verbally, but that's what they think.
Yeah.
The only measure that they have is academic scores. Now, the funny thing is, and I think you and me are old enough to remember, when we used to play football for fun, right? Mm. Today, if your child is going to play football, the parents said, no, you have to join a team, okay, every part of a league. You have to win a trophy. And I can say, hey, you know, my kid is playing at the national level or the state level. I only play if there's a purpose to it. Mm. I've got kids who are 5 years old and playing chess, not because it's fun, but because they are junior grandmasters. Mm. So every parent says, look, I want to see measures that show that my kid is doing better than other kids, right? Mm. And the thing is that the focus on now play and just exploring for the heck of exploring is going down the drain. So what happens is that when you have a parent send their kid to school or college, even though the school and college says, look, yes, there's football, there's cricket, and there's fun, the parents say, look, what are the high scores my kid is getting in the academic?
Correct.
Because the parent still has the focus that if my kid gets high scores in school, they'll get into a good college, they get into a good job, and that way. And this is not just in India. Even in America, for example, the parents will put their kids through a rigorous, disciplined lifestyle just to get them to get high scores in their SATs, to get into the Harvards and things like that. And you may have read a few years ago, they had this scandal where parents bribed the teachers of colleges to get their kids in. So the pressure is across the world, just not unique to this country.
Correct.
So I think the problem is that unless you come up with alternative measures of success, you're not able to educate the parents to say, look, you actually can have a creative kid or a resilient kid. If you have to show that that is better than just a high-performing academic kid, you have something to work towards.
So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, I'm from what you would call the boomers generation. I'm 66 years old. The question that I've often asked educators like yourself is that my impression has been that as there's more wealth coming into hands of parents, they're willing to indulge much more their children. I mean, in my case, I'm an army officer's son. Make sure you get your job. There's no gap between one job and the next job, you know. But today people talk sabbaticals. People talk about being able to, you know, play chess, as you're saying, play football, as you're saying. What you're saying is aspirationally parents haven't changed at all.
Yeah, exactly. Because the funny thing is like saying that because today there's so many more opportunities available. Like, you know, so Ashok, when you and me were growing up in the 70s and 80s, there were no companies selling chess. I mean, in terms of, let's say, chess classes, there were no organized sports that actually went to schools and said, okay, pay us money and we'll get your kid be a great cricketer or footballer. So the thing is that suddenly, and this is not just in India, right? I mean, and not just with schools. Today, there's so many options to make you feel insecure about your life and you'll sell your solution. It's a bit like the cosmetics industry, right? So the thing is that only if you feel ugly can they sell you a cosmetic. If there's no problem, they can't sell you the solution.
Well said.
So what's happened is that because the marketing channels have increased, a lot of companies that want to sell you services and products have increased. They will keep on telling your parents, hey, you know, if your kid does not become a junior grandmaster at the age of five, then you're falling behind all the other kids. It's always that myth that say, you know, your kid's going to have competition as it grow up. Trust me, in the 70s and 80s, our parents are the same thing. How are they going to compete in the tough environment?
Because
our parents grew up in the 50s and 60s, right? Every parent is concerned that their kid will not compete in the competitive world. So therefore, now the new panacea, chess classes, structured football, dancing classes, music, everything that builds up the structure thing. But what's getting lost is the kid is actually losing the ability to play and be resilient, because one of the key things that make kids successful, and there's a book called How Children Succeed, the two things that make a kid successful in life long term is grit and curiosity. Grit means the ability to keep on failing and getting up and failing and getting up, and curiosity means discovering new things and using their imagination, right? The current education system is structured, and most helicopter parents are structured to eliminating grit and curiosity in a kid, because every parent says, you know, I don't want my kid to suffer like I did. So therefore, I will sort of shield them against all negative influences. So therefore, the kid never gets a chance to get hurt and to build up resilience. So therefore, you have a whole generation of high-strung kids who can't deal with pressure. Like, and I think you and I, we have seen that when we're hiring millennials. Most of them tend to have very high expectation of what work should be like, where we know work actually is tough.
Right?
They can't deal with that. And curiosity. Second thing is that because the kid has more time to really discover what's out there in the world, the parents said, no, forget about your brains. The right correct answer is in the textbook, and just follow the textbook and you'll do well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't come up with your own answer.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a 3-year-old kid and I'm doing a picture of, let's say, a mountain and a sky,
mm-hmm.
as a young kid, I would paint the sky maybe purple or maybe green.
Mm-hmm.
The parent will hit the hand and say, no, the sky is only blue, nothing else. Mm-hmm. They're not allowing them to grow with curiosity. So
mm-hmm.
I think in a way where, unfortunately, educating a series of high-strung kids who are not able to think out of the box. And I think mm-hmm. the kids who do well are the ones who are not academically brilliant, because mm-hmm. then they get a chance to actually think outside the regimented environment.
So, well, yeah. And, you know, yet, Akhil, when I speak to a lot of employers,
right,
despite such incredible academic achievements, etc., the standard complaint generally is we are not able to find the right candidates.
Right, exactly.
So where is the mismatch between the kids who are coming out after all this pressure cooker system that they're going in, getting all right. these curricular activity inputs, and right. then not being found suitable enough by potential employers?
Good. So let me talk about this interesting, right? So this whole issue about lack of employability is really a more recent phenomenon, right? The thing is, the 70s and 80s, people never said they're unemployable candidates. Why? Right. Because companies in those days were happy to spend at least 6 months to a year or more training their people, right?
Correct.
At that time, you could get a kid from any environment, basic college or in school, forget about college.
Mm.
And the employer would say, look, we are going to keep you on for life. So therefore, we will spend a lot of time and effort training you to become productive, right?
Mm.
So employers were doing that.
Correct.
Two things happen in the real world of work.
Mm.
One is that employers said, okay, let's try to cut down costs. So therefore, we're going to cut down the amount of training. Right.
Mm.
Therefore, the kids have less time to be trained to be productive. And that's because, also don't forget, employers are saying, you know, if I train you, you may take my training and leave.
Mm.
I mean, care about the fact if you get trained
yeah.
and you stay, that's another problem. So employers are less willing to train people. So they want people to be trained ready-made out of college.
Mm.
The second thing is that when you look at what jobs were like in the 70s and 80s and 90s, they're more repetitive jobs, right?
Mm.
That means that you could sit down and do data entry, do basic stuff, which is what computers are doing today.
Mm.
But those days, you could get away with just doing repetitive stuff. Everything was fine. You were trained, did repetitive stuff, you kind of. Today, all the repetitive stuff is being automated, right? So therefore, they expect students to think independently, to be resilient, get the job done. But the kids don't haven't got that training from academia.
Mm.
So the employers are not going to train the kids. And they expect the colleges to come up with trainable kids, but the employers are not defining what employability means. So you now have this dichotomy. So let me put it this way, right? So when you look at employers hiring from, let's say, an IIM
mm-hmm.
or a Harvard, right? They have no idea how good or bad the educational system of IIM
Correct.
Or Harvard is.
Mm-hmm.
All they say is, look, because the kid who's gone to IIM, we know for a fact he's going to work very hard because he's studied very hard, he knows maths and logic very well because the entrance exam.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Even if I am added more value in those 2 years, we don't care. It's a filtration mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So all employers basically do is that they say that, look, we have a filtration mechanism to determine is this kid employed or not. We have no idea how the kid is or what the education is.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you always have the elite colleges like Jamnalal Bajaj, IIM, getting great jobs for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens to the thousands of other colleges in tier two, tier three cities who don't have that brand name?
Correct.
So that's where, again, the problem arises.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, it goes back to the, repeating again, the factor of how do you come up with signals or measures that indicate that the kid's employable, and how do you mm-hmm. articulate specifically as an employer to the colleges, this is exactly what I want, can you train kids?
Mm-hmm.
To that level?
And yet, Akhil, this debate has been going on at least for the last 50 years,
yeah.
that for a lot of our schools, we've got to be able to impart vocational education.
Right.
So that a large number of people can then get employable
right.
In areas which they may not necessarily be ready to go into the corporate jobs and into government jobs, etc.
Correct.
So is vocational training an answer for employability?
I think when you define the term vocational, right, let's make a distinction what vocational means and what our impression of vocation is,
sure.
right?
Sure.
Vocational means basically this is education or training that makes you effective in whatever your vocation is, right?
Mm-hmm.
In our mind, vocational education has sort of been translated into blue-collar jobs. Okay, you work in a factory, you become a plumber, carpenter, or you work as a factory supervisor, the manufacturing world,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
Now, the problem is that when you look at the vocational world, especially in Asia, right?
Mm-hmm.
most of the people who are trained for vocational jobs, like let's say plumbers, carpenters, factory workers, they are not able to move up the value chain in terms of revenue, in terms of income, right? You will never really join the middle class or upper middle class in from that manufacturing mindset, right? Yes, in Germany and European countries, yes, you can become very, very rich, become a plumber and carpenter. In fact, you have to be licensed, even be a lorry driver. So in fact, that is a great pathway, which is why vocational education has done very well in Germany and done very well in Australia, Switzerland, where you have to be licensed to do any vocation, right? Now, the other side is, when I look at vocational education, there's also being conflated with IT. Because so a lot of companies, a lot of organizations are training students to become great programmers in IT. That is vocation. Those are hard skills. Now, that is considered vocational education as well. But the problem is, most jobs outside of, let's say, information technology, legal, and let's say chartered accountancy, or maybe project management, most of them are more amorphous. They more focus more on the soft skills. So, for example, what is the vocational education that you will impart for somebody who wants to be a sales manager in Hindustan Lever, right? Or become, let's say, a relationship manager in HDFC Bank? There's no standard hard skill beyond, let's say, CRM software, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is that, yes, you do need to impart relevant skills to the kids in vocational. Yes, beyond maybe knowledge of computers and knowledge of, let's say, office software. But vocational education per se is not really the answer to problems, especially in India, where kids say, I don't necessarily want to train as a plumber, right? If I want to become a plumber, I'd rather apprentice myself to a senior plumber, earn while I'm learning, versus study and get a diploma as a plumber, because frankly, there's no value for that diploma.
Great response. Thank you. And now I'm going to switch to the other extreme, which is that, you know, as someone who runs so many franchise colleges and that you've done your PhD, I've often asked this from education leaders. Why don't we have more research in our institutions in India?
Very simple. Who pays? The thing is that when you look at the classic research institutions, right, in the US, UK, and China, most of the research comes from government, right? They say government self-defined, we will fund primary research, right? Let's define research as primary research, which has no direct immediate value. And secondly is commercial research, which is really contract research on behalf of companies, right? So a lot, because there's a strong tradition of government funding for research in the top universities in the US, UK, Australia, and China, there is ability for funding for researchers. So therefore, there's a good model there, right? The second thing is that when you look at companies contracting research to colleges, which is, for example, Cambridge, they have a lot of biotech companies which are funding research, and they all have a biotech cluster outside Cambridge. Now, again, that is funding for specific products which are going to be useful in the market. That's a lower cost of funding research than actually having your own research lab in the company. So as long as you have an ecosystem that's willing to pay for research which has no immediate outcome, which is the government will have to pay that, or university endowments have to pay for that, or you have companies who are willing to pay for direct product creation. So, unfortunately, in India, we don't have that tradition, right? The government's definitely not going to pay for research. The government is right now trying to struggle to get enough kids literate. Forget about funding research, right?
Correct.
And the second thing is, companies themselves, the problem, because there's no strong IP protection in this country, the thing is, companies are not willing to do a lot of primary research themselves or outsource it. So, therefore, there's not much funding for research in India.
I understand.
So, therefore, that comes in. Which also comes to an interesting point. When you talk about rankings for universities in Times Higher Education or let's say QS, what people don't realize is that most of the rankings are based on research output, not on teaching quality.
Right.
And if you look at this, so therefore, they say, how many research papers have you published in global journals? And based on that, we will define what your ranking is.
Correct.
Now, the problem is two. One is that why the top universities tend to be Western, because A, they have connections with all these academic journals, so therefore they can get their people published. Secondly, they have the money to come up with. Now, honestly, and I've done my PhD, trust me, a lot of research is quite boring.
Okay.
Read these journals, but it's just... Yeah. Now, in India, we do have our academic journals, but the problem is it's not as highly ranked as, let's say, a Springer or a PLOS ONE or things like that. We just don't have that skill set. So therefore, you have academic research coming out in India. You're doing it in journals. You have these academic conferences where you're presenting papers. But would I say that there's groundbreaking research coming out in this country? No. Again, for the same problem is that there's no funding. And there's no... So therefore, Indian universities will have a tough time going up the rankings based on research. ISE does it because they have the money for research.
Correct. Very interesting. And I've got time for one more question. And this question is for the thousands and thousands of people who will listen to our conversation. Based on your own amazing understanding of education, what would you say are three lessons you would want our young viewers and listeners who may be young parents to take away from our conversation?
Very simple. The starting point is that your education is not based on schools and colleges. Your education is life. Yeah. So start with a mindset of constantly learning. And learning can happen from a lot of places, from your friends, from books, from good quality information, right? I mean, the thing is, honestly, talk may be fun, but it's not really a source of great quality information besides maybe every talk. So the thing is that look at every experience that you have in life, every interaction with someone as a chance for learning, because you're learning never end. The second thing is learn to enjoy failure.
Yeah.
Because the problem is that a lot of people say, if I try this and if I fail, what'll happen? So what? So many people have done very well in life because they've gone through so many failures. In fact, I think it was Churchill who said that true success is to go from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm.
Correct.
So be willing to take the risk, and even for you young parents, please let your kid run around outside in the mud and fall down and scrape their knees. It's not the end of the world. It'll actually make them more solid and more resilient. Right?
Correct.
And the third thing, and I think, and this is something more philosophical, is that don't take life so seriously. At the end of the day, maybe, let me give an example, right? So when I ask people the question, right, who was the richest man in the world during Buddha's time? Nobody knows. Who was the richest man in the world or person in the world during Edison's time? Nobody knows. Or Gandhi's time? Nobody knows. The problem is that the people who are so-called successes today, people will forget them within 20 years after they die.
Correct.
Right? However, the people who actually live on forever are people who've contributed something to the world, like a Buddha, like an Edison, like Gandhiji or Mandela. You would definitely not call them rich in any way, in terms of, let's say, money. However, they came up with products or services or something that changed the way people live or changed the way people think. If you really want to be considered success long after you die, forget about accumulating money. Just do something that adds value to the world, and ultimately, that's your legacy. And again, have fun while you're doing it, because you're going to be dead.
Well said. And on that note, Akhil, and your three amazing lessons, education is a mindset. Constant learning is the key. Second, you said, was learn to enjoy failure. And that's such a powerful comment you made. And the third one, which is that don't take life so seriously. Thank you for speaking to me about your journey. Thank you for talking to me about the Shahani Group and all the amazing work you are doing in not just schools, but in colleges as well. Thank you also for talking to me about how you're managing to handle education, technology, recruitment, and so many other things. Thank you for speaking to me, and good luck.
Thank you very much, Ashutosh. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.